Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight on The Big Show, director Peter Himes discusses his exceptional career and his new film, Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. Filmmaker Kim Adelman shares her insights on the short film form, as outlined in her new book, Making It Big in Shorts. And actor Kevin Zegers talks about his new role opposite Ben Kingsley and Jim Sturgess in 50 Dead Men Walking. Coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Welcome to another terrific episode of Movie Geeks United. We got some great guests lined up tonight. My name is Jamie.
And my name is Jerry, and we welcome to you to another wonderful episode.
How are you doing, man?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm good. Have you gotten over the Inglourious Basterds buzz yet?
No. Not far from it.
Have you gone back to see it a fourth time?
No, but I hope to soon, but probably not this week, but maybe next week.
Okay. Because you got to save money to eat. You know, you can't just be.
Oh no, I can give it all the. It's worth it. I mean, the two and a half hour buzz that you get lasts a long time. You know,
that's good.
Quite remarkable. It's unlike anything I've seen in a long time.
Well, I have not yet seen it.
Okay.
Isn't that terrible?
You've been busy. You got other things to do. So.
I co-host a movie show, and I haven't seen the number one movie in the country. I wanted a programming note before we get started tonight. For the past several months, we've started a new series, two new series, Inside the Classics, where we celebrate and explore, obviously, the classics of cinema, as
right.
The title would imply, and the new classics, where we choose a movie that was made post-1980 and try to shine a spotlight on that and go and examine those films in depth. Last month we did The Last Tango in Paris for the classic and Casino for the new classic.
We just did Casino. We just did that on Sunday.
Right. Very fruitful shows. And we've determined our next Inside the Classic film.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be Fritz Lang's M.
There you go.
Yeah, that's exciting. That's a good movie.
That's an awesome movie.
Calling it a good movie isn't justice.
Yeah, I mean, no, it's awesome. So,
but actually, speaking of Fritz Lang, he actually factors into our first conversation tonight.
He does.
Yeah. I'm going to keep that a secret. It's all about building up expectation here. just listen to these films. Capricorn 1, Outland, The Star Chamber, Running Scared, 2010, The Presidio, Narrow Margin, Time Cop, Sudden Death, The Relic, End of Days, these are just a few of the films that grace the resume of our first guest tonight, writer, producer, cinematographer, and director, that's quite a hyphenate, Peter Himes. His new film out in theaters on Friday, September 11th, is Beyond a Reasonable Doubt, a gripping thriller starring Michael Douglas, Jesse Metcalf, and Amber Tamblyn, and Orlando Jones. And here is the trailer for that film.
Did you murder Doris Ruth Owens?
I did not.
So why are you on trial here today?
Because I wanted to be.
An investigative reporter chasing the ultimate story.
District Attorney Mark Hunter is faking forensic evidence to get convictions in murder trials.
A district attorney with a perfect record.
We put bad guys away, that's what we do. He shot her 3 times.
An assistant DA torn between them.
You really are a good reporter. You said you had an idea. Well, go follow it.
Now, she can't tell where the truth ends.
You might hear some things.
What kind of things?
Not
things.
I hope you're not letting your personal life interfere with your work.
And the lies begin.
You're in a lot of trouble. There's something you're not telling me.
Trust me. I have been investigating the DA for some time.
Do you have any proof?
You think we're being set up?
We can't have that, can we?
I'm begging you to go and find out for yourself. Do some digging on your own.
I want everyone to know what a scum you really are.
I put away the bad guys.
Please, you're my last hope.
You do know they monitor the phones here, don't you?
Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. Coming September 2009.
Right. It is a great pleasure to welcome to the show Mr. Peter Himes. Mr. Himes, hi.
Hi, I'm Peter. I'm not Mr. Himes. Mr. Himes.
Welcome, Peter. Welcome hi. To our show.
Welcome to our show. Absolutely. Thank you so much. I wanted to start out with where you started out, because I know that music and art were passions for you early on. When did filmmaking come into play?
Oh, well, I started as an art student, went to art schools, mm-hmm. basically from the time I could walk, studied music also, and began writing really kind of obnoxiously and precociously when I was also young. A lot of lowercase poetry.
Mm-hmm.
I seek in my life a lot of spaces, frailty, that kind of stuff.
Right.
Which,
yeah, I know what you mean there.
Well, the High School of Music and Art, that could get you laid. So, I kind of, when I was in college, I felt that the best amalgam, I also come from a very politicized family. I come from a blacklisted family.
Mm-hmm.
And so politics is a big part of my life. And I kind of felt that the best amalgam of imagery and words and music and everything was documentary film.
Yeah.
And I graduated high school when I was 16, and I graduated college when I was 20, and I went to work at CBS News. And what I wanted to do was to make documentary film. So I was with CBS News for almost 7 years. And then realized I not only was a lousy documentary filmmaker and a lousy reporter, I cared much more about taking a photograph that was good-looking than a photograph that was accurate.
Hmm.
I described my career as a reporter as somebody who was totally unencumbered by fact. So I just quit. I said, I want to make films. Like a lot of art students, I studied photography.
Right.
And studied it classically. I mean, from monorail photography and Scheinflug techniques to working in labs and doing all those things. And then I honestly and truly was quite stupid. I was married when I was young. I wasn't stupid because I was married. I was stupid because I quit and came home and told my wife, I'm going to make films. And I thought all you had to do was write a screenplay and somebody would like it and somebody would make it. I really had no clue that it was the odds were idiotic. So I quit, and I wrote a screenplay, and Paramount made it. And it's just blind luck. It's complete stupidity and blind luck.
Yeah.
Well, it is for most people. I mean, most people just marvel at, you know, how they got through. But you've always been a writer, haven't you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, I've always been a writer and a photographer. And it's just the kind of thing when you look back on it and you look at the odds of it, it scares the piss out of you.
Mm-hmm.
So...
But one of the things that interests me with a writer-director such as yourself, they seem like two totally different disciplines, because one is solitary and the other is obviously collaborative. So I'm curious, both sides of that brain work equally well for you, it seems?
Or equally poorly. you know, when I get interviewed, I keep on being asked the same question because I'm a cinematographer, and they go, why do you wear so many hats, or how do you wear so many hats? And I say, because I don't have hair. I don't know where one part ends and another part begins. Mm-hmm. That's the real truth. The real truth is that if you paint or you draw, you see something, mm-hmm. and you draw it.
Yeah.
And when you write, you hear something or see something, and you write it. And when you direct something, you see and hear a film, and you make it. So I'm not sure. I've never found the lines of demarcation between one and the other. I just don't know where they are.
Right.
And things like photography, for instance, it's a language. And if you speak it, it's easier. You know, if you were working in Tokyo and you spoke Japanese, it would be easier just to talk to somebody in Japanese than to have an interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And I am a kind of firm believer, a passionate believer, in if you fail, fail on your own choices.
Right.
Right.
And you know, I can't give an articulate or an eloquent or even an intelligent answer to your question other than saying it's just what I am or what I do. I don't.
Yeah. Well, it's who you are. I understand completely. In terms of influences, though, let's talk about, first of all, in terms of music. When you make a film, do you refer to a particular composer or musician more than others, any other for inspiration? And the same with art. Is there an artist that you use for inspiration more than any other?
Well, certainly when it comes to painting and drawing, I mean, to me, Edward Hopper and Lucian Freud are the painters who get me in when it comes to lighting. I don't think there's ever been a cinematographer who can surpass Rembrandt,
mm-hmm.
and if you,
okay.
Or Caravaggio. And it's easy for me to be influenced by people because everybody's better than I am. So, I mean, I think William Goldman said it best. He said, basically, listen, when we start out, we've already read Shakespeare, so we know we're second rate.
Yeah,
that's true.
And that's William Goldman.
Yeah.
You know, who's nothing short of brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
If you are an art student and you're a serious art student, you study the great painters, and you study the history of painting. And most people who want to be musicians study and listen to great musicians and great composers. There is something a little odd about film where a lot of people who are making film have no real sense of what came before. I mean, the blank look on people's faces when I talk to a class and mention films, it's like it's difficult to find people who have a memory that stretches farther back than June.
Do you find that that's with this generation more than the ones that preceded it?
I don't know.
No, it's actually not, Jamie. I know exactly what he's saying. If you mention anything, I know if you didn't mention anything before, well, it used to be, I wanted to say 1970, but now if you mention anything before, you know, really 1980 or 1985, people look at you. I get people who are our age in their 30s who have no idea what I'm talking about. And I'm mentioning Douglas Sirk or something, and I just I get like a look, who's that? Or Fassbinder, or it happens every day. I mean, I get just blind looks, you know, like, what are you talking about?
And it's odd, because again, if you want to be an art student, you spend a lot of time in museums.
Mm-hmm.
You first learn to literally copy paintings. It's a discipline that most art students have done. I can't think of anybody who was a musician who didn't study or didn't listen to the great composers or the great musicians. I was a drummer. I wasn't a violinist. I was a jazz musician. Except you still listen to Beethoven and Bach, and you listen to Miles Davis, and you listen. You know, you can't do what you're doing without appreciating where it came from.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And not out of, it's not even out of respect. It's just kind of you just know more.
Right.
And there is something strange about film. I think the main reason is that this is an unscientific number of my, I believe that 99.999% of everybody who's in the film industry is not in it because they have a calling for it. They're in it because they want to be in it. And the overwhelming majority want to be in it for the wrong reasons. They want to be in it because it looks easy, and you don't have to take a math test. You don't have to. You don't have to know all the bones in the human body, and right. you don't have to know chemical formula. So it looks kind of easy, and you can get laid. And
well, it kind of makes me want to do it when you describe it like that.
I can't think of anything more difficult. I don't know of anything more difficult.
You have to have a lot of patience. I mean, it takes forever to make being on a set for like 16, 18 hours.
I have no patience. I've never had patience. People
I know, but
always,
I'm just saying there are people who believe that it's like, you know, all what you've just described. It's not that at all. I mean,
I've had on my wall for 20-some-odd years a quote, which is from Sir Carol Reed, who said, making a film is all work and worry, all fear, and all heartache. Not making a film is worse.
That's he's right.
Yeah, you know. And I believe, again, rather passionately, that the only way you could ever succeed in any artistic endeavor is if you don't aim high enough. If you aim high enough, you must fail.
Right.
Poet said it better, a man's reach must exceed his grasp.
Exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for.
What's a heaven for.
Yeah.
So you must fail. So you have to kind of embrace the nobility of the attempt and withstand the pain of the failure and get up off the canvas and try again.
What are the most valuable lessons you've learned from what you perceive as your failures?
That I think, I don't know why I'm going back to William Goldman, and I think he's right. I think nobody knows anything. I think basically when you start out, you're pretty impressed with yourself. And you sit and you look at what you've shot, and words are coming out of people's mouths when their lips are moving, and we go, wow, I did that. And it's like, that's pretty cool. And then the more you do, the more you realize how bad you are and how bad it is.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow or other, the better you can see, and the better you can see, the more you can perceive the gulf between where you are and where you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a gulf that gets wider. It doesn't get narrower. I remember when I did 2010, and Sidney Pollack, besides being such an extraordinary filmmaker, was a very kind man, and he was very, very kind to me. He was like an uncle to me, and he was just very generous of spirit and time with me. And he called me up before the film opened, and he said, how you feeling? I said, Sidney, I'm scared shit. I'm a grown up now.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it would get better, and Sidney said, "Oh no, it gets much worse."
Mm.
And it was like getting hit in the head with a hammer. I went, "Oh my God," because I had really looked forward to kind of getting older and things not getting you as crazy as they got you before, and things not hurting as much because you put them in perspective. And Sidney's right; the opposite happens.
Mm-hmm.
You aim higher, and you fall farther short, and you can see better, so you know you're not good.
I hear you say, because I spoke to you once before, and I've heard you be kind of self-deprecating. As you are, and I understand your point
of
view.
It's not. I'm not doing a party trick. It's really what I feel.
Well, I hear the same thing from someone like Woody Allen when he says, "I start a project and I have the best of intentions, and then I look at it and I 9 times out of 10 I'm so disappointed that it's not
you
the
ever
masterpiece
see Dave
I
tonight?
Set out."
Yes. See Dave? Well, there's a point in there which basically says, "I started out trying to make the greatest film in the world. I'm halfway through and I just want to get it done."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. With me, I'm more like Charlie Brown. I convince myself each time that Lucy's not going to drop the ball and let me kick it. And so I rev myself up and I attack it so fiercely and with such kind of, with all my heart.
Mm-hmm.
And then I get done and I look at it and I go, oh shit, it looks like my stuff.
Yeah.
That's really what happened.
Well,
I know
let me
what
tell
happens.
You.
We love your movies.
So.
Yeah,
you just lost whatever credibility you had.
But I did want to say something. About a long time ago, when we saw 2010 in the theaters, and we really loved it. But I was always hoping you'd go back and make the other two books in that series as I got older. Because
well,
I really enjoyed what you did with 2010. It was a
very,
very hopeful movie.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. Well, you know, the film was a departure from the book.
That's true.
I politicized it and kind of made it about the politics of the time.
That's understandable, given the time that we lived in 1984. Completely understandable.
You just sometimes you do something and you feel like you've done it and you have just no desire. I could never imagine wanting to do another a sequel to a film I've done. It just doesn't seem
right. Okay.
I don't know. You have a limited amount of time.
That's true. Okay.
And I just can't see wasting it.
Let me ask you about your new film, Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. Where did the inspiration for this project come about?
I made a picture called Narrow Margin with Gene Hackman.
Gene Hackman.
That was a good one.
Wonderful in that movie.
Yeah.
Thank you, which I had written and directed. And it was from the RKO Library. And the man who's head of RKO, Ted Hartley, said, I'd love you to do another one. And I went and looked through all their stuff, and I saw this movie, and I went, that could be a terrific film. If it was, like, really rethought. Because, again, having, you know, spent part of my life being a television reporter, and I just thought to make it more about journalism than about law, and so I kind of danced around that project with Ted Hartley for, 8 or 10 years, more. And finally, the kind of things aligned, and I said, okay, I'll write it. And so I just did it. I thought there was a chance to make the kind of movie you don't see a lot now, which is essentially almost a film noir thriller with young people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like people get to see either Transformers or they get to see a movie with a whole bunch of grown-ups. And I thought, gee, wouldn't it be interesting to kind of make the kind of grown-up movie except make it with young people?
Right.
That's a good...
And this is the Fritz Lang film, the original.
It's actually the last film he made in America.
Wow.
And I don't know anybody. And again, I don't know anybody who saw it. And it's really interesting because it's coming back now to me, because different studios have announced 3 or 4 of films that I wrote and made that they're remaking.
Outland just got
Outland. They talked about Capricorn One. They've talked about Star Chamber. They've talked about Monster Squad. I mean, it's just really interesting. I'm on the receiving end.
Is that flattering to you?
No.
It's not.
Isn't it flattering? Just out of curiosity, why wouldn't it be?
Because the only reason to remake it is if you think you can somehow or other make it better.
I understand that, because you have people like John Carpenter and Wes Craven gladly selling off their children to be remade.
No, I mean.
So, but you don't look. Okay, I understand where you're coming. You actually respect what you've done. You don't see any reason for it to be tampered with.
Well, no, I mean, and I'm sure somebody will make it better than I could have done. I mean, I'm sure they will. I mean, I hope they do. But it doesn't feel great.
Okay.
So when you look at
nobody would remake The Godfather.
No,
you're right there. You're right.
Nobody would remake The Godfather.
According to you, and according to what we've talked about, there are people probably who don't even know what that movie is, and in 20 years they're not going to know. I'm not kidding. There are people in 20 years. All these movies that from the 70s that we hold like near and dear are going to be remade. I guarantee.
Well, you know, Gus Van Sant might remake The Godfather shot for shot. That's always a
I just want to know who's going to play Brando.
Stand has made some pretty wonderful films.
Oh, he's fantastic.
Yes,
we
yes,
love
yes.
him. In terms of reworking and kind of modernizing Beyond Reasonable Doubt, as you've spoken to, tell me about that journalism angle and what interested you about that track.
Well, I wanted to make it about television reporting because, I mean, again, it's something that about which I have some firsthand knowledge, and I know what that world is like, and I know what the press is like a bit, having been on both ends of it, both the asker and the answerer of questions, and I thought it was just an interesting world and an interesting take, and I know how, you know, we have been through in the past 10 or 15 years some pretty avaricious reporting, not all of which is true, and you know, people have won big awards and stuff they made up, and I thought it was really interesting to get into that world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is dying. The journalism that we once knew.
I don't know if it's dying. I mean, I'm not somebody who thinks that everything's going to hell in a handbasket. I just don't believe that. I just think, you know, when I wrote Capricorn One, I wrote it because my parents grew up in a time where if they saw it in a newspaper, it was true.
Mm-hmm.
And then you read about William Randolph Hearst and you see things in newspapers and you know they're total bullshit.
Right.
And then I grew up in the generation that if we saw it on television, if Walter Cronkite said it, it's true. And now we know how full of shit television is.
Right.
So I kind of went, gee, wouldn't it be really interesting if I made a film about a story that had to, by definition, be told with only one camera, which is what the moon landing was.
Mm.
There weren't multiple cameras. There weren't multiple vantage points. I thought, boy, if you could manipulate that, it'd be an interesting story.
Yeah.
And you know, then we see a country that was marched off to war on totally fake stuff.
Right.
You know, you read the when I was a kid, the Gulf of Tonkin, it turns out it was fake. If you had told me then that it was a fake thing, I would, it's impossible. 50,000 young men, essentially mostly men, die in the war in Vietnam, and it was based on a fake thing, and then Bush drags everybody off to Iraq on with just complete and utter lies. I thought, I think the one good thing that's going on right now when you talk about journalism is as dangerous as blogging is, and is because it doesn't necessarily have to be as sacrosanct as the Edward R. Murrows and the Cronkites and those guys were. There's something better about having a whole bunch of vantage points. And if anybody uses Fox News or CBS News or NBC News or the New York Times as their sole window into what's going on in the world, they'll be totally misinformed.
Yeah,
some on purpose and some not on purpose. However, we have the advantage of we can check 20 different things online. We can read firsthand accounts of what's going on in China and things. We can read and then make our own choices as to what's fact and not fact. So I don't think things are worse at all. I mean, study what happened when William Randolph Hearst controlled the flow of information.
Sure.
To the United States of America, and how long he did it.
But let me ask you this, though. Speaking of the run-up to the war in Iraq, everyone, all the organizations you just mentioned, were guilty of, you know, buying into...
Totally.
Totally. I mean, even the New York Times, Judith Miller and her front page story...
Totally. Totally. Yeah, one of the worst offenders.
Yeah.
So
I mean, what happens
when
all the sources, all... You say 20 sources. What happens, let's say... 18 of those 20 sources are not, you know, just buying into the propaganda.
I don't know. you know, I don't have answers, and I certainly don't have the wisdom for it, except I just know that if you are as voracious as I am,
mm-hmm.
in terms of trying to find things out,
right,
you have a chance of having a better perspective than my parents had.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, we who are all cinephiles, we talk with reverence about Citizen Kane as if it's the Holy Grail, and what we tend not to remember is that almost nobody saw it because William Randolph Hearst squashed it.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, it won, you know, it became hallowed and actually was recognized by the Academy. Just go look and see how many people who saw Citizen Kane in the movie theater.
Right.
Not a lot.
I hate to jump from this serious subject to this kind of question, but
please, no frivolity.
Just real quick, and then we'll let you go.
I'm in no rush. Don't worry.
I want to ask about collaborating once again with Michael Douglas in this new film.
Michael, you know, Michael has the kind of grace that you cannot be taught. He's just one of the most gracious, interesting, kind, generous, stimulating people I have ever had the good fortune to be around in my life.
Mm.
I don't know what to say other than that. He is truly amazing, and you can do this a long time like I have been doing it and scratch at it as I have been scratching at it, trying to get competent at it. And still, you look through a viewfinder and you go, fuck me, that's Michael Douglas.
Right. Have you noticed a change in his creative process? Because you worked with him at 83, I think it was, with Star
yes.
Chamber.
Right.
How has he changed as an artist, do you think, in that time?
Well, I don't know. He was just so great then, and frankly, he was just so great now. I he's stimulating. You know, he's just so smart.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been very lucky in certain facets of my life, and one of the facets is, you know, I've been able to spend intimate time, and there's very few things more intimate and more raw than making a film,
mm-hmm.
With people like Michael Douglas and Sean Connery and Gene Hackman and Harrison Ford, and you see people at their most vulnerable, you see people, whatever bad qualities you have, whatever really shitty qualities you have, they're going to come out when you make a movie.
Yeah.
And Michael and Gene and Sean and Harrison, people like that, the more you scrutinize them, the closer you get to them, the more pressure they're under and you're under, the better they are, the more you fall in love with them. Billy Crystal. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I don't know anybody better than Billy.
Yeah.
And
that's one of the great films of the 80s, too, by the way, Running Scared.
Well, thank you,
Anna. That's how I feel about it.
Just, you know, 90% of directing actors is casting.
Right,
mm-hmm.
right.
And the other 10% is basically not getting in their way.
That's it, yeah. Let me ask you one more question. Our next guest is on the line, and we'll close out after this question. But I'm curious, because you've been in the business for so long, for several decades, I'm wondering, during that time, how you've witnessed the industry change and how it has affected what you do.
Well, the biggest change during my career was the introduction of sound.
Okay. All right, well, we know that's not true.
How has the business changed? Well, I, to be really, really honest with you, and it's a negative, it's not a positive, I think that the business is now being run by people who don't love movies.
Yeah.
That's been true for like the last 30 years, at least.
Yeah, the business was originally run by people who aren't necessarily nice people, except they loved movies.
Yeah, they wanted to be there.
It's the field of dreams thing. If you build it, they will come. And now the movie business is run by people who they're like a car company that thinks an automobile is a pretty shaky way to get around, except if somebody really famous wants to drive one, they'll build one. Mm-hmm. And they seem not to remember that the automobile industry became a big industry because people said, I'm going to build a great car and people are going to want to drive it. And the other significant sea change is that when I started out, like a lot of people, the only way I could make a film was if I could convince people to give me money.
Mm-hmm.
And now, because of the technology involved, if you want to make a movie, you can make a movie with your fucking phone.
Yeah,
that's true, yeah.
So movie making to people who want to do it is like drawing. I mean, all you need is a number two soft pencil and a pad.
Right.
And the technology now is you can make a movie if you want to make a movie. And you can fail. And you can fail many times, and you can do it privately, as opposed to people up until 10 years ago, your failures are all public.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's a great thing.
Yeah, me too.
I think it's a truly great thing. And then when you go look and you see District 9, you go, I'll take that.
Yeah.
Because I think the films that are being made now, I think the amount of talent that's around now is certainly as great as it was ever.
Yeah.
You go look at Paul Thomas Anderson, and you look at Charlie Kaufman, and you look at Wes Anderson, and you look at David Fincher, and I mean, how much better can you get?
That's you got it. You're saying all the right things. I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they each gave me money.
Oh, but I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, there is a wealth of talent.
Unbelievable talent. Unbelievable talent, and irreverent talent, and talent not willing to play by rules, and
original and voices. Yeah.
Absolutely
yeah.
Fabulous. I mean, you know, you sit there, and I mean, I just went and saw District 9 over the weekend. Your jaw hits the ground.
Mm-hmm.
It's so
yeah,
good.
You're right.
And the guy made it for $30 million. So the real incompetence are the people who are running the companies, because
mm-hmm.
they don't know how to make that move for $30 million.
They make
and if you went
million.
To them, and if you went to them and said, "Here's the script, and I can make it for $30 million," they'd say no, because they'd say you can't do that for $30 million. If you went to them and said, "Give me $150 million," they'd consider it.
Mm-hmm.
Then they'd say, "Because we're spending $150 million, we can only make it if a great star like Will Smith or somebody makes it."
Sure.
So they shut out the whole thing.
Right.
I mean, I had a guy with an executive at Fox one time, quite a few years ago, said to me, "We want to get out of the $40 million movie business. We want to be in the $20 million movie business or the $80 million movie business, because the $20 million movie business is upside down, side, yada, 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 and the $80 million movie foreign, and DVD, yada, yada, yada." And I said, "Great. I don't think you have to have a great sense of history. I have to know who Greg Toland was. You don't have to know who Greg Toland was. It just would be nice if you had a memory that stretched as far back as August." So you...
It's not going to happen.
You, Fox, you want to get out of the $40 million movie business. I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to pull an H.G. Wells lever. And you not only are not in the $40 million movie business, you haven't been in the $40 million movie business. Okay? You, Fox. So let me tell you what you haven't made. You haven't made The Omen or The Omen movies. You haven't made Star Wars or the Star Wars movies. You haven't made Alien or the Alien movies. You haven't made The Home Alone or the Home Alone movies. You haven't made The Die Hard or the Die Hard movies. So would you mind telling me what the fuck has kept Fox on Pico Boulevard except the $40 million movie? And what is the $40 million movie? The $40 million movie is the $110 million movie without a gigantic star and without a very, very famous director.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I've heard that argument so many times. I've read the arguments from studios that those mid-level movies are too risky for them in some way.
Yeah, go look at District 9 and see what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And because it's easy to go to your board of directors and say, "I'm making Hancock 2 with Will Smith." And they go, "Ah, and then you go, I'm going to make a movie called District 9. It takes place in South Africa, and it's about some kind of strange-looking aliens, and it's with nobody ever heard of. And they go,
Yeah.
I mean, Alan Ladd Jr. was head of Fox, and for whom I made a couple of films, told me the story of when he went to his board and said he wanted to make Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And they looked at him and they said, well, what's it about? And he sat and he thought and he said, it's about a Wookiee.
I remember this story. Okay, yeah.
You know, God bless Laddie. You know, that's the only reason why that movie got made.
That's just
someone believed
right,
in
yeah.
it. Somebody believed in it and believed in George Lucas.
Well, Peter, we could talk to you all night, and I want to do this again.
I want to.
Yeah, I really want to. We got to do this again.
I wear
sometime.
Very thin very quickly. Don't worry.
Well, we love your movies, and we're crazy about you. And please come back to us in the future.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That is director Peter Himes. A great conversation. His new movie is Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. It opens in theaters on September 11th. Stars Michael Douglas. It's a political, it's a thriller.
Cool. It's coming out just like, you know, Narrow Margin came out the exact same time in 1990, in the fall of 90.
Yeah.
You know? It's really like sort of a nice, like, moment of deja vu there. But
Right. Let's get to our next guest. She's been patiently waiting, and I'm so sorry we're running late. Kim Adelman is here. She's the short film correspondent for IndieWire, and she teaches at workshops across the U.S., Canada, and New Zealand. The producer of 19 short films that have played over 150 film festivals and garnered more than 30 awards. Kim knows the in and outs of the short film form intimately. She shares this wealth of knowledge in her book, Making It Big in Shorts, the second edition of which has recently been released. It is a great pleasure to welcome Kim Adelman to Movie Geeks United. Kim, are you with us?
Yes, I am. I enjoyed listening to Peter.
Thank you. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry we're running
fascinated.
Late. I loved your book, and it taught me a great deal. And I'm curious why the second edition?
Well, this is embarrassing. When I wrote the first edition, YouTube didn't even exist.
Wow.
And how can you? And isn't that amazing to think? In 2004, when it was published, YouTube did not exist. So the short filmmaking world has changed so radically in the last 5 years, I was embarrassed to have the first edition still out there. There was also advice like, you know, send your films to festivals on VHS tape.
Mm. Oh, dear.
Yeah.
See, I don't mind an error before YouTube, but, you know, VHS is something that, as technology's gotten better, I don't miss VHS that much.
Not at all.
But I do remember a time before YouTube. I know probably most of our listening audience doesn't, but I do.
Well,
tell me how YouTube. Tell me how outlets like YouTube and iTunes and you know they're all over the place. How they changed the game for the short filmmaker.
Well, when I first started making short films, which was back in 1997, way back then, I would go to festivals, and all the filmmakers would complain, nobody can see our short films except at festivals. You know, very hard to get them on TV. They're not being shown in theaters. Where can we get people to see our short films? And now, that's a ridiculous statement. Short films are everywhere. You can see them on your phone. You can see them on YouTube. You can download them from iTunes. It was also interesting listening to Peter talk about District 9, because, you know, District 9 was originally a short film.
That's right.
Called Alive at Joburg, which you can see on
YouTube.
There you go.
No, but it is great for that function. I mean, it is because, you know, how else are you going to get, you know, it is for the documentaries, too. I mean, it's been just a gold mine in that regard.
It's really exciting and very lovely. And, you know, yes, not a lot of money being made via showing your film for free on YouTube. But if you argue that short films aren't really money makers anyway, and you're making films out of love and to get it seen and to get an audience, how fabulous is that? You could make it, you know, you and I could make a film right now, put it up within an hour, and, you know,
that's right.
Thousands of hits later.
Tell me what the misconceptions are about short films amongst amateur filmmakers.
Well, here's one thing. Almost everybody who makes a short film is an amateur filmmaker, but I don't think we should say amateur. I would say anyone who makes a film is a filmmaker.
That's right.
Right. Or beginner filmmakers.
Exactly. A first-time filmmaker, something like that. Well, especially in the festival world, where we consider a lot of short filmmakers making a mistake is making a short that's too long.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people think short films have to be like 20 to 30 minutes long, And seen again by the YouTube generation, that's ridiculous. Everyone wants to see films that are, you know, 5 minutes long, 10 minutes long, 12 at the max. But it kills me when filmmakers spend thousands of dollars to make these really expensive 30-minute long films, and nobody wants to show them.
Right.
But tell me, first of all, how you came into filmmaking, because what were the films that veered you into that direction and kind of changed your life?
Well, I actually was in a very lucky situation that a friend of mine worked at the Fox Movie Channel, which is a movie that shows movies from Fox. Interesting enough, Peter was talking about that, too. I was thinking of Fox Evening. But anyway, it's a channel that shows movies from Fox without commercial interruption, so there's a lot of airtime that you have to fill when movies are over and the next one hasn't started yet.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to make short films, original short films, to be shown on the channel. And we shot them in lovely 35 and then sent them around on the festival circuit to promote the channel. So in a three-year time period, we got to make 19 short films, all shot on 35, all went around the world, as I said, at 150 film festivals. So it was really a miracle situation where I was paid to produce short films, the filmmakers were paid, we all got to shoot on film.
Mm-hmm. And tell me the beauty of that form, because how does it differ from feature films? What is specific to short films?
Well, the obvious answer is the length.
beyond the length, yeah.
Well, the nice thing with a short film is you can do absolutely anything in a short film. And that's why, you know, when everyone bitches about filmmaking, oh, it's so pedestrian or nothing good is getting made, every year thousands upon thousands of really amazing short films are getting made. And we're always on the cutting edge. Again, I cite the District 9 example where everyone now is buzzing about it. But, you know, 5 years ago, everyone was seeing the short and buzzing about it. So, you know, you can really be on the cutting edge of what's getting exciting with filmmaking. And because there are no rules for short films, you can
mm-hmm.
do pretty much anything. And you don't have to do three-act structure, and you don't have to do, you know, you can do really elaborate special effects, or you can do cheap-ass special effects, and equally impressive and equally beloved by audiences.
Right.
Yeah.
So anything goes, and I think that's really lovely.
I want to talk about some of the common mistakes that people make when they venture off to make a short film. At each stage of the game, you mentioned that they tend to be too long. So starting from the writing phase, what does the filmmaker have to keep in mind when they're constructing an idea for a short film?
Well, a lot of people, because they're used to reading feature scripts, that they're really reading like sales scripts that were written beautifully so that people would say, I would like to buy this film, you know, purchase and hire expensive stars and make this film. But when you're writing a short film, you're actually writing for something that you're going to make, and hopefully you're going to make within the next month. So you don't need to write it beautifully, and you shouldn't write things that you can't achieve. It's really much more a blueprint for a film that you're going to be making, hopefully, very shortly.
Right.
Yeah. And you go through certain genres in your book that are most successful in the short film.
Well, because I also, again, think people sometimes think, I don't have a good idea, or I have this really ambitious idea and I don't know if I can make it. And there's no law that says that has to be the very first film you want to make. If you want to just go up and shoot something next weekend, there's so many easy things that you can do fast and quickly with no expense, really. And you can make a fun little film that you could throw up on YouTube and people would enjoy, and then you'll feel more confident for doing the big, expensive film.
Right.
So I was saying, you know, like, people always think I'm joking when I say this, but doing a joke, taking a little joke and putting it on film can be really effective as a short film because jokes have strong setups and payoffs. So it automatically gives you a structure that you can write on, and if you can tell a joke, you already know your whole plot.
And there's great avenues for that online, too.
Oh, totally. I mean, if you go look at Funny or Die.
Yeah, Funny or Die or College Humor. I mean, if you could get on one of those two, the amount of traffic and the amount of attention would be incredible.
Yeah, they love them. And I mean, who among us do not know jokes
right.
that we couldn't adapt quickly to shoot?
Yeah.
So I believe in that. I believe in, like, doing mockumentaries
mm-hmm.
where you do it as a false documentary because then your production value doesn't have to be too big. And it's, again, something you could just think up real quickly and run out and go and do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's always really fun. And then, you know, you can also do it more like, do you know a personality? Somebody who has a lot of personality that you could construct a cute little short story for them and go film them tomorrow. So it's a personality-based short. And those tend to do really well because on the web, people like personalities.
Right.
Or a location-inspired short, you know. We have an office building. What can we set in an office building? Let's go shoot on the weekend when no one's in.
Right. And do you consider the short film an essential training ground for someone that wants to make features?
I think you'd be very smart to do a short first, because you'll learn a lot and you'll make a lot of mistakes that you won't make that same mistake later when it really counts and there's a lot of money against it as a feature.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, if you could argue one of the major skills for directors is to work with other people and work with actors, shouldn't you get that experience first doing it on a short level?
Yeah,
that makes a lot of sense.
I completely agree. And one of the pitfalls for the beginning short filmmaker is working with the actors.
Yeah.
And finding quality actors as well.
Bad acting and bad sound are the two things that kill most short films.
Yeah.
And there's no getting around that.
How do you recommend finding those actors that will bring something special to your project?
Well, hopefully you'll know some people, or you audition people, or cast towards their strengths.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're just going to have your buddy do it, then don't write him something that's going to be really difficult for him to act. Write towards what he can actually do.
No, but it is a common mistake, though. You know, we cast our friends or whatever, and you know, it doesn't always work out for the best.
But if it's a short and you didn't really put any money into
yeah.
it, write it off as a little learning experience.
That's right. It's like a kind of not expensive, but a time-consuming home movie.
Exactly. And that's, again, short should be a learning experience for everybody. So nobody's going to, you know, points off and say you never can be a filmmaker again since you did that.
Right.
Yeah, and the festival circuit, once you've made your short and you shop it to the festival circuit, marketing is just as important as any phase of the production, isn't it?
Well, and festivals are basically the marketing platform for short films.
Yeah.
So, but if you argue that you want to use a short to become a feature filmmaker, festivals are the great way to learn the people who are in the feature film world and to meet people and to network, and your short film is your ticket into that as a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, short filmmakers who get into, for example, Sundance, they get to meet incredible people who will really help them on their career and their efforts to get get a feature film made. So, you know, festival, and you'll meet buyers who could potentially get your film for television and earn you a little money back.
Yeah. So are there, because you hear about the scouts from the studios and such that go to the feature screenings in festivals, are there scouters that look for short films as well?
Yeah, because, again, that's where the talent is. That's where the young people are who are doing different and unique things, and a lot of foreign filmmakers, too. That's the first time we're going to hear about them is from a short film that's playing at a festival. So it's a great opportunity to discover new talent. So, yeah, that's exactly how you can get an agent to pay attention to or a studio executive. Also, a lot of film festivals, they'll show a short right before the feature. So you sometimes
right.
sneak at the door that way.
Mm-hmm.
Tell, you have a chapter on this in your book, and we have yet to talk about this on the show, but I've had experience with it. Without a Box,
yeah.
What is Without a Box?
Without a Box is an interesting organization that kind of built up about because of the whole festival world, and in the modern era where you could put all, you know, when I did festival applications, I had to type out every single one of those every time. It was so annoying. And now, Without a Box is like a central place where you can type in all your information about your film and then submit to festivals via that. So it's kind of a tool for filmmakers and for short filmmakers especially,
mm-hmm.
because we tend to apply to a lot of film festivals. It's
mm-hmm.
really worthwhile.
Yeah. I see it all the time on the festival circuit, this Submit Now to Without a Box, and I've never been able to ask anyone about
like,
it.
What is this exactly? Yeah. They've got message boards, too, where filmmakers can say, oh, this festival is not worthwhile, or this festival is. So it's a nice resource for filmmakers, too, to find out what other filmmakers have to say.
Yeah. I hate to skip around, but I wanted to ask about the production of a short film as well. Raising money. Because now the tools are within reach for most anyone.
Exactly. You know, because I teach short filmmaking, that's always the very first question everyone asks. Where do we get money for short films? Where do we get money? And, you know, in other countries, their governments have money for short films. And that's
yeah.
why you see really expensive foreign films that look amazing. And it's hard for us to compete in the U.S. because we don't have a government who's kindly putting out money. And there are a couple places you can apply for grant money, but my position always is, you got to go for shoot what you can afford to do now rather than spending a lot of time trying to find where the potential is a grant and applying for it and hoping that maybe in a year you'll hear if you get $10,000. It's like, no, go shoot a film right now for $5,000. Not for $5,000, for $500. Sorry. You're like, what is she talking about? No. Go film, you know, shoot a film for $50. You can do a short film now for almost nothing. You can borrow a camera. People are always obsessed to like, well, what should we shoot it on? And for short films, it really is whatever camera you can get your hands on for free, that's what you should shoot it on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and most of the available cameras now look more than sufficient. I mean,
yeah,
more than sufficient quality to shoot your films on. With the students that you teach, when you talk to students now, what are they like, this new generation of filmmakers? Do you find them really enthusiastic and brimming with ideas? What are they like?
Oh, totally. Very much so. But also, they're really used to making films already. You know, they've had cameras in their hands since they were in high school, where there was a high school filmmaking class, you know?
Right.
And they're very used to YouTube and loading up things and shooting things on their cell phone.
Tech savvy, you know.
Yeah.
They're born with it. I mean, with that.
For them, it's not like this thought of like, maybe one day I will scrape together money and make a film. It's
mm-hmm.
like, I've been making films since I was 8. And that's great, isn't it?
No, it is great.
It is fantastic.
Yeah, I wish our high schools, like, you know, did that when we were growing up, you know, had
exactly.
like film workshops and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book. It's called Making It Big in Shorts, and it's available now. I believe we have the icon on our homepage there.
Yes,
if you click it, it'll take you directly to the Amazon link where you can purchase the book, even as you listen to the show.
Well, there you go. And
there's,
also, just make short films. You could make a short film as you're listening to the show as well.
You really can. And it's so wide open now. And it's encouraging.
It is.
From a standpoint, because you hear all these new voices.
Yeah.
But it also empowers pretty much anyone to believe that they can make a film, doesn't it?
Definitely. So
yeah.
I leave you with the thought of, I hope everybody does.
That's okay. The most encouraging, yeah, definitely.
Put it up on YouTube, share it with all of us.
That's right.
Absolutely. Kim, thank you so much. I love your book, and thank you for sharing it with us on the show today.
Thank you, Kim.
Delightful to talk to you guys.
All right, thank
you.
You
too. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Okay, that's Kim Adelman. The book is Making It Big in Shorts, available now on our website.
Yeah, she was great. What I liked about her is, and I also like Peter and many of the guests that we've had on the show the last 2.5 years, but she reminded me a lot of Blake Snyder. Very friendly, very
yeah.
eager to help.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
As, you know, you don't growing up, you don't hear about these people, but the last couple of years, we've been blessed to really get these people on the show who are very eager to share their success with others.
Yeah, and share their knowledge. And there's something about truly creative people that
mm-hmm.
that is generous. They do tend to be very generous.
Yes.
The best
lucky.
Creative people. I mean, we could tell that just speaking to Peter Himes tonight.
He was wonderful. He was
that
great.
He had that, yeah. Okay, I believe our next guest is on the line. And this is exciting. Our next guest started acting at the age of 6. In 1993, he got a big break as the lead in the hit Disney film Air Bud. And over the course of his career, he's shown tremendous ambition in the projects he's chosen, delivering stellar work in Zack Snyder's sensational reworking of George Romero's Dawn of the Dead,
mm-hmm.
as Felicity Huffman's teenage runaway in the moving Transamerica, and in his latest role opposite Jim Sturgess and Ben Kingsley in the gripping IRA thriller 50 Dead Men Walking. Defying expectations at every turn, his upcoming projects include a reworking of the classic Bonnie and Clyde, where he will play none other than Clyde Barrow. And it is a tremendous pleasure to welcome actor Kevin Zegers to Movie Geeks United. Kevin, are you with us?
Yeah, hey guys, what's up?
Hey, what's up?
Hey, Kevin, how are you? Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you're from Canada, right? You grew up in Canada?
Yeah. I grew up and started acting in Canada in a little town called Woodstock, which is about 2 hours outside of Toronto, and
mm-hmm.
have been living in L.A. since I was about 17, so seven
wow.
years now.
Did you come from a particularly creative family?
No, actually, I guess I would say sort of the opposite of that. My dad's a miner. He works in a lime quarry, and my mom was a hair stylist. So, you know, they were just sort of, it was never really something that was advocated in our house. It was just sort of something that I think I always enjoyed. And
mm-hmm.
when you said 93, God, that's a long time ago. But I think, you know, I think having done it since I was a younger guy, it just sort of, I don't really remember the moment that I decided, hey, you know, I'm interested in this, or hey, I have the need that I have now, or as an outlet to sort of be creative. I don't really remember that moment. I just sort of have always been doing it. So
you kind of fell into it, and you just kept doing it.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think I did it primarily because it was fun, and when you're, you know, 11, 12, 13, I think it's just, you know, it's attention and it's nice and you get to travel. And but I think not until I moved here by myself and I think started living a real life, a life on my own, and
right.
sort of where I had to figure out whether I wanted to pursue being a really good actor or just sort of work. And I think my decision sort of happened probably while I was doing Transamerica, and kind of from that point on, I've just kind of said I'm going to have a go at it. I'm going to, you know, I don't think that there's anything wrong with sort of wanting to be a great actor.
Right. Well, no.
Not at all.
But I think a lot of people are, it's much more in vogue right now to just be good and to sort of shut up and look good and go to work and be good. And I think that that's, at least in some circles, sort of all that's necessary or all that's desired of, especially someone my age. So I think, you know, it's certainly a lot more work, and it's certainly not as easy a path to sort of go along when you want to do, you know, the kind of movies that I like to do. It's not the most sought after path. Let's just put it that way.
Mm-hmm. But when developing this passion for acting, are there films or performers that have been particularly influential to you?
Well, I can watch a movie. I think the thing that I like most about myself is that I'm like a huge fan of movies. I'm inspired and in awe of certain people that I just am aware of my own shortcomings enough to know that I could never be like. There's only ever going to be one Daniel Day-Lewis. He's just like a completely different kind of human being. And I think someone like Philip Seymour Hoffman, but I definitely don't necessarily follow the people that whose careers I would like to emulate. It's more the opposite. People who just sort of have this natural inclination to be creative, and I also really seem to follow and like character actors a lot. People who can, you know, I always say to people that I work with, somebody who can come in for, you know, three or four scenes, sort of like Philip Seymour Hoffman, and just sort of like level the entire movie for 20 minutes,
right.
And people are kind of reeling for half an hour after he's long gone. And I think for me, there's something very powerful in that. This, certainly being the lead in a movie is a whole different kind of pressure, but I like the idea of sort of coming in and sort of kicking the doors down and then leaving, and kind of that being its own thing as well.
Right.
Yeah. One of the things that I most admire about you, and I explained it a little bit in the intro, and you've talked about it here, is how you try to push yourself and you almost work to defy expectations and do something different than you've done before. And I have to know that you know, you're young, you're attractive. You should see the emails I got from girls when I announced that you'd be on the show. So I know the kind of scripts you have to be getting. What is your criteria for choosing a project nowadays?
I think probably to the frustration of a lot of the people that work with me. I think it's I don't even know if it's that well defined. I think it's just kind of something that I feel. You know, I'm reading a script right now, and it's probably the least likely, the one that people who work with me, my agents or my managers or whatever, would be least likely to say, like, oh, that's the one. But, you know, it's just, I feel something. It's something that, generally, it's something that terrifies me. That's the first thing. It's something that, like, I know the first day on set I'm going to be, you know, terrified.
Right.
And then I think, you know, certainly the meeting the filmmaker is, because that's, I think people lose sight of the fact that as an actor, you kind of, doesn't matter, the greatest performances you've ever seen could have very easily been completely screwed up by poor directing or poor editing or whatever. I think,
sure.
You know, a lot of, so I think putting your life, for all intents and purposes, for a few months in somebody else's hands is a very sort of, it's something that I take pretty seriously, because I just, once I'm done, sure, I can go on and do the next movie or whatever, but they're sitting there sort of putting the music together, cutting it together, and they could end up making you look like a complete jackass.
Yeah,
and
it's a huge
for
gamble,
me, that's,
I would imagine.
Yeah, so I think it's a combination of a lot of things, but I think mostly it's that first thing that I said, which is, I haven't done it before. Maybe people wouldn't want me to do it, which there's something, there's a quality that I have, which is sort of like, who is anyone else to say what I'm capable of doing, or what I'm, what I should do or what I shouldn't. And I'm also not, I don't plan on being around for, you know, 3 years. That's like not the goal. I plan on doing this for, you know, the very long foreseeable future. So there's no rush. I'm not in a rush to, you know, give a performance that, or do something that, that sort of defines myself yet. I'm still sort of figuring it out. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. I'm kind of at peace with that right now. So.
Okay.
Well, what has this life taught you about yourself and this work? What has it taught you about yourself so far?
Well, I think, to be totally honest, if I were to sort of do it all over again, I would probably choose another profession. I'm far too self-critical, and it's actually not a great mental, you know, it's not good for my mental well-being to do what I do, because I think I'm constantly, I need to be doing something at all times, and unfortunately, because I am a little bit picky, I don't work as much as I'd like to or whatever. So, I definitely learned that this is a job just sort of like any, you know, like any other, and I sort of try to treat it as such. And it doesn't, a lot of people don't feel that way. And I think I, especially a lot of the people that I sort of came up with, I'm very observant. I try to be, at least, and sort of try to not make some of the same mistakes that other people do. And I want to, you know, I want to make a career of this. I want to be able to raise my family with this and also be proud of work that I'm doing. So
yeah.
That's, I guess, the plan. I don't know what. Yeah, but if I had to do it all over again, I would probably go to film school and maybe direct, or which is what I think I'd ideally like to end up doing anyway. But certainly keep me more engaged for longer periods of time, rather
right.
than sitting here sort of going over every, you know, mistake I may have made or whatever. So that's
kind of
where I'm at.
Yeah, and that's a stumbling block for an actor, isn't it? Because you need to be not – I think the key is to not be self-conscious like that, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that I have, unfortunately, a lot of qualities that are not – that are sort of stumbling blocks, that are just sort of personally about myself, that I think I've done it maybe a little bit too long, that the whole – the novelty of whatever – of the making of a film – it's not something that I get off on the way that a lot of people do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm comfortable doing it, and I'm more comfortable on set probably than I am in my personal life, but I'm not, it doesn't get me going the way that it does other people. It's a far more sort of critical process for me. It's a very like, okay, now I have a job, so I can start doing my sort of preparatory stuff and getting ready to build this character, but it's very sort of X's and O's for me. It's not as magical, I suppose, as it is for some people, and I wish it was, but
you,
I think
like,
I
settled into a routine with each performance, like you have a set routine that you go about.
A process, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm, which is again why when you mentioned it earlier, I could never be Daniel Day-Lewis, because there's something that happens, there's something that goes on with him
mm-hmm.
that I don't think that my body or my mind would allow to happen without it being very aware of it. So I think which is why I think I'll probably be a much better director than I am an actor, but
what? I think you're a fantastic actor. I wasn't questioning your ability.
No one's questioning your, and especially a very, very career so far, too, very diverse films.
And you actually, you'd mentioned that Transamerica was a turning point for you, and I know that you campaigned for that role, so you must have recognized that potential early on. What was that potential that you saw?
Well, that was going to, I was about to just be done with the whole thing in general. I was just going to stop acting. I was like, this is not for me. And mm-hmm. and that was the, I read one script and I was like, okay, I'm going to do everything I can to get this movie because this is the kind of movie that I like. Mm-hmm. And if it works out, great. And if it doesn't, then I'll find something else to do. And yeah, I met with Duncan, the director, and he said, yeah, no, sorry about that. Like, I don't want, you know, the kid from Air Bud starring in this, like, very serious, really cool movie, and which I completely understood, but at the same point, I kind of said, well, I need to clearly show him that I'm capable, and so I put myself on tape, and then I had a few phone conversations with him and just kind of generally was a pest for a while, and then I sort of ended up there, and I ended up in New York with the two of them, and throughout that whole process, all of the crap that had built up over sort of 10 years of what I thought was acting, which really wasn't, which was just sort of, you know, showing up and saying lines and, like, winking at the camera, which right. is, like, not, was sort of torn down and by both of them, and that was the first time that I realized that there's a whole lot more to figure out. And I was nowhere near where, you know, I thought I was. And I think that was a good experience for me.
Yeah.
Because I have a lot of things now, but what I definitely know is that on any given day, there's any number of people who are much better or much more suited for a certain thing. But what I do know is that I at least pride myself on, I'm probably the hardest worker when it comes to a film. So I think the reason that I probably continue to work is, people generally know what they get with me when they hire me is I'm from the second that, you know, that I know that I'm doing it is sort of full bore for as long as they need me. So,
right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when you, how did 50 Dead Men Walking, come about for you?
Well, I did a movie with Kari, the director in Canada right after I did Transamerica. I did this movie called Stone Angel with,
Ellen Burstyn, right? And
yes,
Ellen Page.
Ellen Burstyn and Ellen Page, yeah.
Yeah,
and,
I like them. I saw them a couple years ago. That was a good movie.
Yeah, so, and we were just about to finish filming, and she's like, I'm going to go to Belfast and do this movie about the IRA. I was like, cool, that's great. And I didn't really believe her because everyone says, you know, they've got their next thing. And then she called a few months later, and she's like, so, you know, I want you to come with me. And there was some sort of movement in who was going to play what character, and she just knew that she wanted me to go with her, and we had sort of struck up a friendship. And then Sir Ben came on, and then Sturgis came on, and it sort of just fluidly came together, and I just ended up in Belfast sort of trying to get really fat and trying to, like, build this guy who I was sort of in a personal space of, like, giving everyone the finger at that point too, which was like, I'm not going to do all this stuff that everyone wants me to do. I'm going to, like, go and do my job. And I think that's really what this whole, the whole job sort of represented for me was like a good turning point in my life, which was like, I want to do this the way I want to do it. And it needs to be personal. And I think the reason I'm proud of this movie and the performance was, it was sort of, it went a little too far for personally and professionally, and I think I like that.
I
like that it just sort of, like, it messed with my life in a way that work had never done before, and I think the fruits of that labor sort of end up somewhere on the film, hopefully. So,
well, you had to, I would think that you had to absorb the culture of Ireland where you were shooting. What did that environment give to you?
You know, I have to say, I came back a completely different person. There's really no room for, arrogance is not the word because I don't think that I was that. There's a lot of stuff that I think just living in LA and doing what I do, it, like, sort of accumulates in your life, and mm-hmm. there's really no room for that there. It's very sort of people go to work and they do their bank job or whatever it is that they do. And then at 4 o'clock, everything closes and everyone like comes together and there's like a sense of community and no one talks about what they did at work or, you know, it's just sort of like this enormous sense of like, enough with everything else. Let's just like, we're happy to be alive. We're like, you know, there's not bullets buzzing by our heads and
right.
there's not helicopters overhead. So there's like a, and I think I really got off on that. I think both Jim and I did was, you know, Jim had, is, was, and is still sort of going through that whole whirlwind of like what he's going through. And me on a completely different scale was going through something similar personally. And I think we both sort of ended up, you know, at some house party in Belfast, sort of really exhaling for the first time in a while and sort of saying, like, I like being away. I don't, we were so not reachable to anyone else. We were doing our accents and, like, going out and getting ready to work really hard. And I think that sometimes it's nice to be away and sometimes it's nice to be in a place where they don't know the difference between, you know, a video camera that someone has on the street and a camera that we're using to shoot the film. And
mm-hmm.
and it was kind of nice. It was nice to feel out of place, but at the same time feel welcomed and
mm-hmm.
and given the opportunity to show these people, you know, for at least who we thought that they were.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about the story, because this is based on a true story, correct?
Yeah, it's based on this book. I think the book was called Man on the Run. This guy named Martin McGartland, so the story goes, he basically started working as a double agent. He was in the IRA, and he was also working for the British government, informing them of these impending attacks or whatever. And the story, or the film at least, goes that there's sort of two sides pulling at him, not his sympathy for, I guess, my side or my character, which is sort of the IRA side, and then Sir Ben's side, which is sort of, you know, he obviously doesn't want people, you know, exploding in bars. And so I think that the thing he struggles with most is kind of figuring out which side he sort of falls on. And the thing that I wanted to do, and I know that Sir Ben wanted to do also, was to sort of not present either side in a way that was more charming than the other, or more, it shouldn't appear to be an easy decision. And
mm-hmm.
I think my instinct to not make, you know, my character and everything that my character represents ugly and dark, and, you know, there has to be something likable and inherently appealing and homey feeling about this guy, and that's sort of, you know, it shouldn't have been an easy decision, and I don't think that it was. So
yeah. So your character though, Sean, it's obviously based on a real person, correct?
Yeah.
Do you feel like any kind of added responsibility when you're playing someone from real life as opposed to a fictional character?
I think I put a lot of pressure on myself in general when it comes to work. So I wouldn't say that it affects me when I'm working, I think, more than any other factor. I think I feel responsibility to the director and the writer. I very much feel like I'm there to service the story, and that's fine with me. And
mm-hmm.
So it didn't really make a difference, to be totally honest. I definitely felt a responsibility to the people of Belfast. I felt like getting the accent proper and the walk and the talk, you know, the whole deal was like something that they can smell from a mile away. And
right.
both Jim and I kind of wanted to have it be completely authentic. And
mm-hmm.
So for me, that was, you know, I feel more of a responsibility to, because I actually never met the guy who I played. I met, I think, people who were like him, but I don't think I actually ever, and maybe I did, but maybe he didn't introduce himself to me as that guy. But
right.
I think I definitely overthink everything, and I feel responsibility to just about everyone to kind of do do whatever I can. So
I have to ask you about the latest project before I let you go, because I've gotten the emails that I've been sent. They've all asked me to ask about this project because it's a source of tremendous fascination. The story of Bonnie and Clyde. I know you're about to start production on that. What direction is this story taking?
Well, it's certainly a very different story. It's obviously the same people, but my hesitation, I suppose, at first was, you know, that's a tricky movie to remake, if at all, ever, you know. And
I would imagine there's a lot of trepidation to filling in the shoes.
So upon talking with Tanya, who is, I actually think, a fantastic director, this woman who's doing it, and Hillary a couple of times, I think the story is definitely much, much different. It's telling a very, it's actually a much more, autobiographical story of the last little bits of their life. But listen, I'm terrified. I think maybe dumbly enough, I that's, like I said earlier, that's sort of what I look for. So I'm certainly going to go in swinging. I don't think that there's any reason not to. I also don't know exactly when we're going to start shooting. Could be this year. It may not be until next year. So as far as I'm concerned, there's a couple other things that I'm going to do before that. So I haven't really buckled down and sort of started completely digesting the magnitude, I suppose, of that that endeavor.
Yeah. But that is a common theme, and you just mentioned it, and you mentioned it earlier about facing your fear when you accept a role. That's an important part of the process for you, and I'm wondering, when you look at a 50 Dead Men Walking, what is the fear? What is that fear?
Well, for me, for that movie, I'm a vain person. I own that, and I think not until I was there did I fully own it. And being as naked and as sort of like broken down as I've ever been, because I've been on set my whole life. I'm used to like hair and makeup, and you know, there's like a whole process that goes on that guys or girls. It's very different, and that movie was that for me. Mm-hmm. I was very uncomfortable in my own skin at that time, and I think that the best way for me to show it was to actually be very uncomfortable in my own skin. I know I'm not doing my job if I'm not on set with some sense of huge anxiety that I'm about to completely mess it up. And the day that I have that feeling, I'll stop doing it. I think the thing that I've learned from people like Sir Ben and people like Vince D'Onofrio and these people that I've been so fortunate to work with is like they're always terrified. And Sir Ben says something so vivid before we started shooting, which was like, we all have the exact same amount of experience with this project.
Right.
There's no one has a head up. He said it doesn't matter what I've done, what Jim's done, what you've done, Kevin. Like none of it matters. We all have the exact same experience with this story and with these characters combined. So what are we really talking about? There's no need for so he said he's always terrified. There's always that sense of anticipation. And I think the second that goes away, I think you're just phoning it in and you should probably be doing something else. Certainly I will be something else.
But where does the joy of the process come in for you?
I like the whole thing. I'm such a sadist. I'm like, I like the anxiety. I like there's nothing better, you know, there's nothing better than, it's like bungee jumping. There's nothing better than showing up, you know, and I read this great interview with Dustin Hoffman, and he said something about, I'm still waiting for the day when I show up and someone calls me out that I have no idea what I'm doing. And I think there's like that feeling of I'm like doing this. And there's like, so I think for me, that's the, it's the first, generally the first day that we're filming where I'm like doing something or in the midst of doing a scene and I'm like, this guy never existed before today.
Right.
And I think for me, that's what I get off on. And I get off on, I there's sort of like endless possibilities as to where I could end up or where I could end up, what I could end up doing. And none of them would surprise me. I could, you know, I could fall into three or four great movies and completely redefine myself, and or I could, you know, who knows? I think that's the sort of the unknown of it all is something I really like.
Yeah.
I like that I know I have a lot to learn and forward to figuring it out.
Well, I think you're doing great work.
Yeah,
and
excellent work.
Congratulate you on all your success, and I wish you the best of luck in the future. And in the future, come back and talk to us. We'd love to have you back on.
Yes, please do. Would love to, and thanks again for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much,
thank
Kevin.
You.
Anytime.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
You too.
You too. Bye-bye now. All right, that's Kevin Zegers. The movie is 50 Dead Men Walking. It's been getting just rave reviews.
Yeah. Do you know the release schedule for that? Is that gonna? It's gonna, I guess, start out limited, but is it gonna expand? Hopefully, it's.
Yeah, I believe it's in limited now. I just saw Ben Kingsley on Charlie Rose. Charlie Rose.
That interview he did with Quentin. I have to say, one of the best interviews Quentin has given.
He is the best interviewer of creative talent.
He is, without a doubt.
Because he knows just enough to ask the questions, but he's so curious to know the answers. He doesn't ask a question that doesn't stem from his curiosity.
Yeah, he's great. I mean, with every interview, but you're absolutely right. He is probably the single best interviewer of creative talent.
I study Charlie Rose, and I hope one day I'll be able to
ask a question half as good as
Charlie Rose.
Well, okay, you actually bring up a very good point about interviewing and everything, and this is something that goes back to when Bill Maher had Larry King on a couple months ago.
Yes,
and he
says
you want, people aren't coming to hear me. They want to hear what my guest has to say, and you have to create this environment to get the guest to really, you know, spill it, if you were, and that's what they're coming here. You know, no one really wants to hear what you have to say. They want to hear the guest.
Right.
And he's absolutely right. And I think Charlie Rose has definitely taken that, and just some of the interviews I've seen over the years, like, wow, just really incredible stuff that you're not going to get anywhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. I believe 50 Dead Men Walking is in limited release now.
Okay.
I'm looking it up just to verify it.
No, it's very fascinating because the actor Jim Sturgess, who I would imagine that our friend Jason O'Brien of Oscar much loved, because he's Jim Sturgess is in his favorite movie of last year, 21. So it's just it seems like a very Kevin and Jim. There are a lot of similarities, and they do pick films that are difficult films. I would say that Jim with Across the Universe Alone is a challenging film for any young actor to be in.
Yeah, and is he involved in Spider-Man? I don't remember if he was or not. I know that...
I don't know what the years you're speaking of the Spider-Man for.
I'm speaking of the Taymor's Broadway show.
Oh, that. Oh, God, that's a different beast entirely. That I don't
because
know.
Because I know that Devin Rachel Wood is.
Oh.
You didn't know that?
These things that they're making, and I love Julie Taymor. I love what she does, obviously. But these things that they put on Broadway, and you know, I don't pay that much attention. For more the plays, I guess, and stuff. But the musicals and that sort of, you know, I'm not as up to date.
Come on,
and
dude.
I thought
you were Mr. Musical Man.
I am. Hey, they wrote the Music Man based on my life. No, as I've gotten older, musicals have, believe it or not, played a big, much larger role than when I was growing up.
Yeah,
but I just have the Spider-Man thing, you know, because you hear the stuff, the Evil Dead musical, this, you know, all these movies becoming musicals, and you sort of think, oh, right, everything's going to become a musical. I'm waiting for the Star Wars musical to come.
50 Dead Men Walking is in theaters now.
Okay.
It opened on the 21st.
Okay.
So it opened last Friday. It's in theaters now, so look that up. It's one of the best reviewed movies of the year, and just a stellar cast.
It is an excellent cast.
So what are you looking forward to, man? Looking forward until next Sunday.
I'm actually, believe it or not, even though the reviews have been mixed, I'm looking forward to taking Woodstock. Just looks,
yeah,
you know, nice and charming. I'm curious, because I read an interview, though, now going to completely opposite extreme, with Rob Zombie at Fatally Yours the other day, talking about Halloween 2. And I'm curious, because he said it's like this is the last time he's going to touch this.
he said
and,
that again.
And I hope he's right. I hope there's not, he's not going to... But he said it's the last time he's going to touch this, and anyone should go on and do other stuff. But he said it's not a remake of the
right.
Halloween 2. He said it's a completely different film. And I want to give him the benefit of the doubt on that. But I haven't heard anything good or bad about this film. I've heard nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a curiosity, but I'm really taking Woodstock is what I'm looking forward to this weekend. And maybe if I can get out of the house, I'll go see a certain movie again. And you know what that is, and
yeah,
can broadcast that all over the internet later.
Well, we've got some work to do prior to the Sunday show, because the Sunday show is a unique...
It's unique, but I think we should emphasize, these are our favorites. These aren't necessarily the best movies.
The
these
best.
Are movies that mean a lot to us. I could do this in my sleep. I could do it right now if you wanted to.
Our top 20...
Guess what?
Our top... What?
I pick a different 20 the following thing, so I mean... That's how I work. So I mean,
well, let me tell people what the show is.
Oh, okay.
It's going to be our top 20 favorite films of the last 20 years. 20 of 20. That's the name of the show.
20 of 20.
Yeah.
Okay. So I guess I don't have to worry about I don't have to go back before 1989.
And no doubling up.
Oh, I would never do that. Not for this. But like I said, I could do it. You know, do something 20 tonight and a different 20 that would have an equal measure.
Yeah, so it's going to be challenging, but you know, we've got some homework. It's going to be fun.
It's going to be a lot of fun.
So in all, with Chris joining us, we'll be reviewing 60 movies on our show Sunday.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Isn't that amazing?
That is. That's amazing.
Yeah. Where else do you want to be on a Sunday than listening to us rant and rave about 60 movies?
I don't know. Am I supposed to be somewhere else? Am I supposed to be like the guest host?
I wasn't talking about you. I was talking about the general listening public.
You want me to be on Back My Midnight instead? I mean,
no, no.
Okay.
And then next Wednesday, I'm sure we'll have a big guest lineup, but we know right now Zoe Bell will be joining
awesome.
Us. We just spoke to her today, and that interview will air next Wednesday on September 2nd. Great, funny, down to earth.
Very
really
down to earth.
Great, great interview. So tune into that fascinating discussion.
It was.
Okay, we ready to close out?
I think we should close out, yeah. Unless
okay,
there's something else you want to talk about.
No, I'm good. I'm feeling
you know
fine.
What I am sort of despondent about, and I think we already talked about this, but I was ranting and raving so much, and we had Aaron on, so I was already distracted on Sunday, but I am kind of disgusted that Shutter Island's been pushed back till February.
Yeah.
I do think that you know, I think that when we were all talking about the last time Chris was on, that was the movie we're all looking forward to, and Paramount must have been listening to us, oh, let's throw these guys a curveball.
I'm sure it was based
I'm
on
sure that.
I'm
sure that's what they did. Those three, especially that Jerry Dennis, I want to make his life miserable.
well, and you know, I think Scorsese is about to be knee-deep in production on Silence.
That's right.
So I'm curious if he'll even be around to market the film if it releases in February.
I know. But we already knew the Wolfman was pushed back, and that's been moved around a couple of times. So
yeah, what is your impression of that? That trailer's just been released. What's your impression of the potential of that?
At least like the first couple of times, I've seen it so many times, but doesn't it remind you, it's very influenced by the Coppola Dracula? Doesn't it remind you of that?
A little bit.
A little, okay, someone said it was more fun and more Van Helsing than anything else.
Well, I would say so. It looks like a Joe Johnston film to me.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And Joe Johnston, it is a Joe Johnston film, so take from that what you will.
folks, that's not really high praise.
I don't want to be snobbish about it, but I think that the project would have been infinitely more interesting had Mark Romanek stayed on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
you know. But I don't know. I could be wrong. Those usually aren't my favorite kind of.
No. But it's interesting. It was nice to see Emily Blunt, though. I like her a lot, and she gets better and better with each movie she's in. But I have a feeling she's just going to be sort of like
wasted.
Wasted, yeah. And it was good to see Hugo Weaving. I like him.
But Benicio del Toro is a brilliant stroke of casting.
We got Anthony Hopkins, who seems to be, that's why I brought up Dracula. You know, because he was in that as the Van Helsing and the Coppola one, so it seems like he can't escape this almost.
Right.
So I don't know.
So that's interesting. Any other trailers?
There's the Avatar trailer, which is.
Yeah, we've talked about that to death. Aren't there other newer trailers that came out?
There is a trailer that's been shown in front of Inglourious Basterds at one of the various screenings I saw. Youth in Revolt.
Right.
Which is based on a book that I read in the 90s, a great book, but it has Michael Cera in it. And, you know, we keep talking about Michael Cera, and I do like Michael Cera, but he seems to be playing the same character over and over again. I'm trying to think if there's anything else other. See, the Avatar trailer is the big thing. That's the big trailer.
Yeah.
And, okay. I'm going to shut up now. I'm just going to shut up.
I did see the Zombieland trailer, and I think
hilarious. And that
looks like a lot of fun.
And speaking of Zoe Bell, the other movie I think that looks good is Whip It.
We didn't ask about that today. The Drew Barrymore.
We're running out of time, but I would have liked to know because she's got that, and she did the stunt work. It's very interesting for another movie that's coming out later this year, Bitch Slap, which is a lot seems like a very Grindhouse inspired film, very Russ Meyer influenced. She's all over the place, but she's got Gamer, and that looks really cool.
Yeah.
The Rub brought up a great one before we go. Inception.
I was just about to say Inception. Yeah.
Okay, guys, great minds think alike. you and the Rub, man, you guys are on top of things. But what do you think of that? What are your impressions?
It's a little minute-long teaser.
Yeah.
It excites me that, and this brings up something else we got to talk about. It excites me that it's an original script from Chris Nolan, who hasn't made a wrong move yet.
Hasn't, that's right.
Yeah, and, Leo's getting better and better, so I'm excited about it. It's there's also some other Chris Nolan news today.
I've heard a lot, but I don't know what's true and what's not true.
It's the latest rumor.
What is the latest rumor?
That Megan Fox has been cast as Catwoman in the next Batman.
I heard that's BS, though. I heard that.
Well, it certainly sounds like BS, and it's being reported by The Sun, I guess a Canadian.
Yeah, you can't take them seriously.
Yeah, they've reported a lot of erroneous scoops lately. And then they go on to state that Chris Nolan and Christian Bale have agreed to come back, and I don't know that that's true.
I haven't heard anything about that.
Yeah.
I really just, I don't know what's going to happen with Batman, the next Batman movie. Every day there's a rumor, there's someone has an idea of what they think they should do, and, I have no idea.
And what do you think about Spielberg remaking Harvey?
Wasn't this kind of remade by Rob Reiner, North? Remember that one with Bruce Willis and...
the movie that Roger Ebert hated.
Yeah, that. But you could also say that Donnie Darko is kind of a remake of Harvey. But I think it's interesting because when he does, he did Always is a remake, War of the Worlds obviously is a remake, and now he wants... He obviously must see something. You're always curious. It doesn't always work out, like in the case of Always or something, but he sees something. There's something that says, hey, I really think I can add something.
Yeah, Always is a good example, maybe, to this, because it does seem, it's a classic. I've done the show once. I'm about to do it again. It works, but it's very nature. It is very old-fashioned.
Yeah.
So... I don't know that it's like when Nick Nolte played when he was up to play Superman, and they terminated him because he wanted to play Superman as a schizophrenic. I think it would be hard to play Elwood P. Dowd with today's audience and not make him a schizophrenic.
No, you're right. But you wonder, though, what is he going to do? How are you going to update it? What are you going to... Yeah, it's just very... You know, I'm just curious. You know, when I first read that a couple of weeks ago, I was like, why Harvey, of all things? What does he see in that that
right.
he wants to make? But maybe that's, you know, who are we to say? You know, people, they want to do things differently. They have different, you know, things. And he's always curious, you know.
It's not as much a head-scratcher to me as his remake of Old Boy with Will Smith.
Yeah, that's the big... That...
Has that been canceled? Has that been...
I know. There's still. Look, the whole trilogy, the rights were bought. It's not just Old Boy. All three of them were bought. I just don't know how. That's a very Korean movie, very culturally. And I don't know how you're. There are things that are going to be lost in translation. It's also what we were talking about with a couple of weeks ago. In regards to our conversation with Rod Laurie, why call it Straw Dogs? It doesn't sound like it's really.
Right.
No, and that's not. I'm not insulting.
Right.
Respect Rod Laurie because you keep up with him on Facebook. He's a very bright guy, and he shares. I mean, this is something I think we should talk about, maybe devote a segment on the show. These filmmakers talking about their daily process, pre-production process of their upcoming films, and he's sharing a lot how his process for this film, for his remake of Straw Dogs. But I am curious, like we talked about, why call it? It doesn't sound like really the Straw Dogs that we watch. So
right.
I'm curious, you know, maybe you might change the name or something.
Well, and speaking of Korean, Shelley, my girl,
saw the vampire movie last night.
Yeah, she went to see Thirst, and she said it was very, it was funny,
mm-hmm.
it was graphic. I guess this director.
He's a great director, and there's Old Boy, there's Lady Vengeance, Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, and there's another great movie on Joint Security Area, and then there are other movies that have not been released here yet, and then there's Thirst, which is playing right now here and is leaving as of tomorrow night. It's only played for like 1 or 2 weeks here, and it's not going to sadly stay around that long, but did she like it?
She did like it. Yeah.
Good.
She said it was an unexpected movie. It wasn't what she was expecting. She was expecting, you know, the scary, spine tingling vampire movie, and she.
I don't expect that from him.
She got something a little more boisterous and silly.
Okay. I learned to come to this because I guess after Old Boy and Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, I was expecting like along those lines for Lady Vengeance. And no, it was much more. It was much different than what I thought it would be. So he's a very interesting filmmaker, and he's another filmmaker that was really Tarantino championed, and why we know more about him and we see his films because he really said, "You guys have got to watch this man's films. They're incredible."
Yeah, what else am I talking about? Other than Zoe Bell next Wednesday, we'll also have Guillermo Arriaga, the writer director of The Burning Plain. He also wrote the screenplays to 21 Grams and the Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada and Babel. And yeah,
he's a great and that movie is on demand right now, so you can watch that on demand. I'm going to try to watch it this weekend if I can.
I highly recommend people do that.
Yeah, it's supposed to be very good. Everyone who you and Shelley have seen it, and you said it's awesome. So
yep, it was one of the best movies I've seen this year. All right, we're going to close out the show. We'll be back Sunday for a big two-hour
extravaganza.
That's right. So, and people will argue our choices for the 20 best films of the past 20 years for 20 more years.
For 20 more years, okay. Or they'll forget about it by the time we exit.
All right, thanks everyone for joining us tonight or on replay, and we'll see you back here on Sunday. Thanks, Jerry.
All right, good night, everyone. Bye-bye.